Nice.
I kind of like this.
You start and
kind of warms up, you know, the does the monologue.
Warms up the crowd. It's like Jay Leno. And then get to...
We were Carson. We were talking, Mr. Chair, about the possibility of getting an update on Senate Bill 171.
That's a good idea.
I had not opened the work session, but if you would like to do that, please.
That's a great idea. Let's open a work session on Senate Bill 171. Senator Metzger, you have been working extremely hard on this bill. Where are you at?
Okay. Thank you, Mr. Chair, members. We hope that we will have a revised bill for you next week on 171. And after you know, some of the discussion after the bill came out of committee, there was, you know, a lot of discussion, confusion, and different points of view regarding the approach of dealing with income taxes of utilities. And as you know, the primary issue of contention in that bill, that discussion, was the consolidated or deconsolidated tax return issue and what impact it doesn't have, et cetera. And so we met, a group of us met on Monday, including the Department of Justice and business and residential consumer interests, who pay those taxes, and developed an approach that we are working on right now in Legislative Council to attack the issue not as a tax issue, as a tax filing issue, so that companies can file any way they want to file, do anything they want to do, but rather as a rate-setting issue, which is kind of how we had originally started looking at this. And to see to it that the Public Utility Commission, when it sets the rates for utilities and it assesses tax liability, that liability actually mirrors the taxes that the taxpayer will actually owe. And we believe this is a good approach, and it will more closely reflect the actual liabilities of the company. And if a taxpayer, as whether it's a residential taxpayer like ourselves or a business taxpayer, knows that the amount of taxes that are included in their rates do in fact reflect the liability that the energy company will actually be having as a result of their operation. And if those liabilities are less than what the tax rate that customers have had to pay for that the PUC will take that into account when they allow those taxes to be included in rates. We believe, based on history, that this could have a significant tax reduction for businesses and individuals collectively for the investor-owned utilities on what we see in our tax bills. And maybe a little bit for each bill for each of us, but collectively it's a lot of money that would be back into the Oregon economy. So that's the approach that we're taking on that. And we hope to have that for our discussion sometime next week.
And who was in your work group?
They were attorneys, because I think we really got to, we'll have a policy discussion in this committee, but I think it was really important that we get the legal issue resolved. And so we had attorneys representing residential customers, representing industrial customers, representing large commercial property customers, Legislative Council, and the Department of Justice. And Senator Walker and myself.
Questions for Senator Pisanski?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Senator Metzger, based on what I'm hearing the work group worked on, it sounds like we would still permit consolidated returns to be done, but the PUC would take in consideration that, say, utility company ABC had a $1 million obligation on taxes. If they consolidated it with other components of their parent corporation or whatever, and their actual tax was less than that, there's going to be some type of an offset as to what would be the future rates. Right. How's that going to? I'm just trying to get a little bit better.
Well, the general concept is, again, it won't have any impact on how they file tax returns. They can do whatever they want under this. It doesn't. It will maintain the status quo. What it will do is have the PUC look at the historical, the most recent 2 or 3 year historical liabilities, actual liabilities. As you recall, tax rates, when they're put into the rate, is an estimate of what that liability is. And we never look at whether that estimate was technically correct in terms of what the liability ended up being. However that liability was created by multiple corporations or whatever, it's just whatever that liability turned out to be to the taxpaying entity. And so what this will do will be to have the Public Utility Commission will look and see what the actual liabilities that were collected by the state and federal governments, measure that against what had been included in rates, and then going forward would adjust the allowable collection of taxes based on what was actual the liability that was filed with whatever entity under however they decided to file.
Okay. Could I follow up with one other question? So in that process, I assume that there was some discussion or will be more discussion as to how a utility may come back and try to justify a rate increase to offset or attempt to offset, let's say, having that adjustment actually occur, and that the PUC is fine with actually going back, getting the snapshot of the actual liability and having that as part of that discussion as to whether there's justification for maybe a rate increase. My only concern is that this is going to be post-fact. Each time they come back for a rate adjustment, which is not annually, it's 3 to 5 years or whatever it might be.
Yes, sir.
I mean, to me, it looks like we're almost displacing the people who bear the taxes through their rates earlier may no longer be in the system to benefit from whatever adjustment occurs for future rate setting. So I just, that's the only thing I see as a possible disconnect. I mean, clearly the whole system's going to benefit because you're going to make those adjustments, hopefully, according to whatever the actual liability was, but the people who actually put the money out from the front end may not be a benefactor to the adjustments.
Yeah. I don't quite follow that, but... the way this will be won't necessarily be a rate case on taxes. This will be a adjustment that would be ongoing because they collect it's estimated taxes for future liabilities, for future taxes, not past taxes. And so they'll look at it when the effective date of the bill. They'll look at the last 3 years and see what has been collected based on the estimates and whether that amount of money actually reflects those liabilities. If the liabilities were substantially less than what was collected, then the PUC would essentially deem that those taxes are already there and would forbid future tax collections until that level of liability had been achieved. If in fact their liabilities were greater, then certainly that would work that away as well. We have heard in testimony in both the Business Committee and the Revenue Committee that theoretically, you know, the profits could be such that the taxpayer would have to pay more in taxes. And theoretically that is true. But as we have discussed in our two committees, in practice that never happens. You know, they're always collecting more taxes from customers than they have actually paid. But it would be a fair reflection that if you owe $5 or you come to me and I say, I think I'm going to have to pay $5 in taxes on this. And I say, okay, then you are allowed to collect $5. And it turns out that you only end up having a $2 payment. Then that $3 would be considered as taxes for future liabilities before I allow you to collect another $5.
So the only other question is, using the scenario, if, say, the bill goes in effect, passes, and goes in effect on January 1 of 06, the PUC could look back, let's say, for the last 3 years, 03, 04, and 05, see what the actual liability was, factor that in as to what they actually were collecting, make that adjustment. As long as the PUC has the ability and its own initiative to look at that, my concern is as you move this forward, there's going to be some need to reflect back as to what the actual liability was so you can make those adjustments. And if it's only at a time of when there's a request for a rate
No, that won't be the case. Okay. It won't be a case where they have to have a rate case to look back. Okay. They'll be doing this on a regular basis.
Fair enough.
Yeah.
Okay. That's helpful. I wasn't clear on that. Any other questions for Senator Metzger? We don't have any language in front of us.
No. Thank you for the update.
Yeah. Mr. Chairman.
Yeah, Senator George.
See, if Farmer can have a shot at this thing. Basically, what we're going to be saying is don't collect more in taxes based on to the ratepayers than you're going to pay, or we'll be back. And basically, I think that will be a positive instruction that they shall not collect more than what they're going to pay. And I think that would be to everyone's benefit to have that be clear, because it's, you know, if you think about it, I've got a 10.5% guaranteed profit, you know, under PUC, and then all of a sudden I'm able to pull off millions and millions of dollars by telling you I'm going to pay a tax, which I'm allowed to collect from you, and then not pay. So I think it just puts everything back on the real plane of the real numbers. In other words, if you collect it, pay it.
So we'll try to get that to us as quickly as we can.
It does seem like, Senator George, it does seem like the at least simplest, as you put it, way of getting at what I've found is a legitimate issue of taxes collected that never actually make it where they're supposed to go. Anyone feel the burning need? We'll have this bill back. So anyone feel a burning need? Great. I didn't think so. Close the work session on Senate Bill 171. Open a work session on House Bill 2197. Mazin, do you want had this bill before us, I believe, last week or?
Yep, last.
The week before?
Last week.
Good memory. Oh, this was the 050505.
Yes. Well, actually, it was.
Even if it wasn't, just say.
It was 05, 05, 10, 05, which 05 and 05 equals 10, so it was a good one, too. So, Mr. Chair, just to refresh your memory on this bill tries to complete the circle, if you will, on the transient lodging tax that was passed in House Bill 2267 in the 2003 session. And at that time, the language seemed to have omitted certain types of lodging facilities that are vacation homes and vacation condominiums, and some other camping grounds and so on. This would allow and complete that circle. If you remember, the transient lodging tax is 1% statewide, dedicated to tourism and tourism promotion for the state. This bill would increase what have been collected or would be collected under the previous bill by about 1.5%. And just to clarify some of the confusion about the numbers that we seem to have traveled through last time, the original estimate from the 03 session for the biennium of 03-05, this is the current biennium that we live in today, was about $16.5 million in collections. Now, have that tax started at the time of when it was supposed to, and the amounts of money would have been coming accordingly, and there was no lag, and everything procedurally and structurally was set up, we would have probably right on the money for the 16.05 million. However, because that wasn't the case, we're not there. Yeah. The same estimate for 05-07 was about 20.41 million, and the same estimate also for 07-09, that's 07-09 biennium, is 22.51. Those amounts, looking this way and under these estimates, still seem reasonable. However, I think that the complaint from the Tourism Commission last time was that there was an estimate of 11 million today, and that probably is not the case. That 22.5 million is until 07, 09. Today, we have about 815 million in this business in the state. This lodging has increased in the last 10 years by about 49%, and we're growing at about 5% a year. So we still think those things are reasonable. 5% per year is a good level of growth.
Questions for Mazen on 2197 or the addition to the 1% we did last session. We're in work session.
Do we have any amendments?
No amendments.
Well, Mr. Chair, it was amended in the House.
Yeah, so there's no amendments.
Right.
Mr. Chair, I move House Bill 2197 to the floor with the do-pass recommendation.
Senator Starr has moved House Bill 2197 to the floor with the do-pass recommendation. Any discussion? Any objections?
Yeah, I don't see the relationship between this and tourism, so I'll be putting that.
Okay, we'll do the roll.
Okay.
Barbara, please call the roll.
Senator Joy.
No.
Senator Metcalf.
Aye.
Senator Kozanski.
Aye.
Vice Chair Sparrow.
Aye.
Chair Duffin.
Vote aye. So this that bill passes to the Senate floor. Anyone like to carry the Senator Brzezinski would like to carry that bill. Close the work session. Thank you, Mazen. And then one bill that we haven't heard yet, Senate Bill 593, is left on our docket. Open a public hearing on Senate Bill 593.
Mr. Chair, before you should have three amendments, and I will tell you why you have three amendments before I begin so that I won't have to repeat myself several times. All of the dash 2 and the dash 3 clarify, or I should say correct, errors that we discovered over the last few days. So I'm just going to focus on the dash 3 and the items that were corrected are listed in the effect of the committee amendments, and you can see they're very trivial, I should say. They're moving phrases around that we're in the wrong place, etc. This bill establishes a property tax special assessment program for land subject to a conservation easement. It allows land presently subject to farmland and forest land special assessment to be transferred to conservation special assessment without payment of additional tax. If disqualified from the conservation easement special assessment designation, additional taxes will be due based upon the difference that would have otherwise been assessed against the land for a period of up to 10 years, depending on how long the land had been disqualified when it was discovered. Upon testimony on 4-13-05, one of the assessors explained that this bill was important because it pertains to owners of property that essentially are designated as farmland and forest land. However, some owners have not declared that they have been given conservation easements to portion of their property, because if the easements were declared under current law, the properties might lose their designations and then have to be taxed at the higher rate that I just mentioned. However, I would like to add that in speaking with Gary Wright at the Department of Revenue yesterday, who drafted part of this the bill, he said that in some cases, if a property owner designated portion of the property for conservation easement, he would not automatically lose his farmland or forest land special assessment if that easement did not preclude him from foresting and farming on it. Okay, so based on that information, I, did a revenue impact that is relatively minor. You've got, three possibilities. You've got conservation easements out there right now that might not have been declared, so there's no revenue loss. You've got some conservation easements out there that will be declared, but they're not precluded from farming or forestry, so there's no impact there. And then you've got the remainder, okay? And my estimate of $90,000 per fiscal, per biennium, it's a little bit higher, actually, than the estimate I went over very briefly several weeks ago with Jerry Hansen, who is the representative for the assessors on wildlife habitat and conservation. He thought, well, maybe $60,000 per biennium, but he wasn't giving me any data to support that. And what I did is I went back and looked at some of the acreage or the number of acres, the value, the revenue loss for the special assessment on farmland assumed a tenth of a percent would be designated as conservation easements, and possibly 50% of that would be actually at risk, okay, for revenue loss. And that's how I came up with the estimate.
Justin Martin, Cheryl Hammond. And this is the first time we've heard this bill, so if you could start us at point A and work us from there.
Excellent. Mr. Chair, members of the committee, my name is Justin Martin, and I'm here today on behalf of both Defenders of Wildlife and the Nature Conservancy of Oregon. I'm very pleased to have with me today Cheryl Hammond, who is a Senior Conservation Incentive Specialist with Defenders, and she will go into the detail that is necessary. A few quick points. We are here to urge your support of Senate Bill 593. It resolves a minor technical problem in the current statutes. It allows landowners to enter into a conservation easement without being penalized by back taxes. Landowners who want to protect their land under a conservation easement may inadvertently be subjected to tax penalties due to inconsistencies in the current state law. This bill would have a very minor revenue impact that you just heard. Depending on circumstances of individual landowners, the impact could essentially be zero. We heard earlier just this day from the counties that they had some concerns with the bill. We were never approached by the counties. We would be more than willing to sit down and work with them. I think they're going to talk to you today about a fee of some sort, and we would love to address that on the House side. We've already passed this bill through one committee, and again, would be more than willing to be at the table with those folks if alerted to some of those problems. With that, I'll let Cheryl discuss some of the particulars.
Hi, my name is Cheryl Hammond, and I work for Defenders of Wildlife in the Portland area, and I'm a Senior Conservation Incentive Specialist. First, I'd like to point out that this bill came out of an interim work group that was represented by diverse state and federal agencies, as well as agricultural and forestry interests, and that was back in 2002 between the 01 and 03 sessions. And that work group met to look at Oregon's conservation incentive programs and develop recommendations. And this particular piece of that process had broad support from a very wide group of stakeholders in that process. In the process were agricultural interests and other private landowner interests. Also, the Department of Revenue was a part of that, and we've worked closely with them and have no problems. We're just trying to, as your staff person pointed out, we're just trying to iron out little details to make sure that this works for them and for us. And so we appreciate their assistance with these the amendments. I would also like to point out that the counties were at the at part of the interim work group back in 2002, and we've worked with them all along, and hope to continue working with them.
So, Ms. Hammond.
Yes.
And everyone, I'm probably the only one at the table that doesn't know this, but what does this bill do?
This bill allows a landowner who has a conservation easement, which is usually a permanent agreement that voluntarily restricts the use of their land for some conservation purpose. It allows that landowner to retain a special assessment that they already had. a special assessment for property taxes. Most people with conservation easements were already in a farm or forest special assessment. So if a conservation easement were to specify that they're primarily using the land for conservation, they may not be eligible anymore for the farm or forest special assessment. And so by creating a conservation easement special assessment, this bill will allow the conservation easement landowner the option of retaining the same lower special assessment, but moving into a new category.
So,
does that answer your question? Or?
It does a lot. It does. Thank you. So give me an example. I'm just trying to, didn't grow up on a farm, and so my colleagues to the left all know exactly what you're talking about, but for me it's helpful to just, okay, so here's an example. We've got a farmer in Jefferson.
I'll actually use a real example. We do have some people who are prepared to testify in later hearings if we ask them to, and we didn't try to have them here today, but I've talked to a number of landowners to try to have some examples on hand. A good example is a landowner in Lincoln County who is right along Highway 101 and has a very scenic property with mature trees on it, and her property right now is in a forest special assessment. And the forestry special assessment requires that you use the forest for timber harvest. And she would really like to concentrate on the conservation values and the scenic value and have a conservation easement on the property. And so if she does that, at this point, if her conservation easement says that she's basically going to use the forest for conservation purposes and not for timber production, then she will lose her forestry special assessment. And in Lincoln County, the Wildlife Habitat Special Assessment program is not available, so she doesn't have another program that she can go, another special assessment that she can go into. And so she will owe back taxes, and then she will be paying taxes based on the full market value. And that's a huge disincentive for people who would like to do a conservation easement on their property.
Very helpful.
Okay. I have a couple more points. Are there any other questions right now, or should I go on?
Well, let's pause here for a second.
Okay.
So any other questions just kind of on the general? Senator George.
The reason, you know, for the tax breaks, you know, for timber, because it's a long time investment, and for farmers, because it's usually low income production, you have to, you know, it's a mechanism to keep them in business, basically. But
right.
But here, but the anticipation is eventually they do make the harvest, they do, you know, generate the products that work their way through the economy. Here, the product is only the scenic value. How do we justify that to our local partners who are saying, well, wait a minute, I'm sure that's what the counties are talking about, is potential revenue loss, and the fear that maybe if the incentives are good enough, that maybe large blocks of productive farm and forest might be moved into never be used again for farm or forest category?
Yeah, I can answer that in a couple of ways. First of all, land that is used primarily for conservation does, in fact, provide very important values to us, aside from simply the production, the potential production value of harvesting trees or crops. For example, clean water, fish and wildlife. Many people in Oregon, in fact, a lot of Oregon's economy depends on people liking the natural values that we have here. So I would say that the economic value of having land in conservation is immeasurable. Our economic system doesn't really account for things like the value of providing clean water. And we all know how important fish and wildlife issues are, particularly with listed salmon and all of the economic impacts that those issues have. A second thing I would say is that in conservation incentives bills that were passed in both 2001 and 2003, those bills, which are now in Oregon statute, recognize conservation as a legitimate land use in Oregon. And so I think providing a special assessment that recognizes that is completely in line with statutes that are already in place that recognize the importance of conservation. And certainly goals 3 and 4 of the Oregon's land use planning system, which address farm and forestry, are very, very important in many ways for Oregon, but there are also goals that address natural resource values. And so there's many places that we can look to that, that say that conservation is very important also.
Follow up on that. You know, 55% of the state is probably closer to 56 or 57% of the state is already owned by government. And I'm really concerned that, that we just continue to diminish the productive portions of Oregon. And to a certain extent, I kind of resent a little bit, I'm just going to share that with you, just a feeling that came over me, of the idea that, that good farming and good forestry results in dirty water. Because if you were really going to be honest about who's polluting the rivers, you would look into the cities as the source of the greatest amount of pollution and poison into the rivers. So to me, there is a little bit of a case where, you know, when is enough going to be enough? When I see government managing its forests and its pasture land and everything else in a reasonable way, I would think maybe we do need, maybe we shouldn't then necessarily move more ground into that status from private sources. Now, I personally believe that that's a good thing, and I've supported in the past the idea of, a, you know, because I'm a property rights person. However you want to use that land, that's your business. Mm-hmm. But I have a little bit of heartburn about granting the same status of tax break as we would for a commercial purpose person that we would know we're going to yield income from. So that was more of a comment than a question. I'm sorry about that.
That's probably at the heart of this issue. So Ms. Hummond or Ms.
Yeah, and I do have another an answer to that.
Okay.
The conservation easement special assessment would be used by a handful of landowners each year. I mean, new landowners would sign up for the program, as it were, per year. The number of new conservation easements in Oregon per year is a dozen or so, less than one per county. And that's because it's a very complex tool to use. It takes a lot of time and money to set it up. It's very complex. There's already a lot of disincentives for using conservation easements. But having the conservation easement special assessment is simply another tool for a private landowner to make the choices that they prefer for their property and not be penalized for making those choices. And in addition, I would like to point out that a conservation easement does not necessarily take land out of production. And in many parts of the country that don't have, like eastern states that don't have the land use planning laws that we have here, conservation easements are primarily used as an open space tool, and in California also. In Oregon, there are some programs that are primarily using conservation easements as an open space tool to protect land from development and to keep it available for both the conservation values and the agricultural or timber values. And a good example would be around the Bend area, which is developing very rapidly. And in that part of the country where it's generally a rural area with a city, the landowners there, both in agriculture and forestry, need a certain critical mass of people remaining in production in order for them to continue having, you know, the feed store and the, you know, the tractor store and the services that they need. And there's a certain economy of scale that's needed. And so in some places, conservation easements are used simply as an open space tool to keep the current use of the land and not to prevent production. And the details of a specific conservation easement are determined between the landowner and the holder of the conservation easement and whatever grant funding or other, you know, sources of money may be involved, whatever other partners may be involved. And conservation easements are definitely compatible with continuing to have production.
That's really a privileged one. Thank you for indulging me in this. If you write a conservation easement that does not provide for any commercial production, it literally just preserves it as it is, okay? How do you ever get it out of that? How do you get it out of that status if we decide that we need those resources, that we need the, agriculture's changed, that we need the production?
A conservation easement is usually a permanent agreement.
That's what I wanted to get to. Thank you.
It is strictly voluntary for the landowner?
Completely voluntary, and it takes so much work to do it that no one could ever talk someone into doing a conservation easement. It's not the easiest conservation tool that's out there. And actually, in addition, I'd like to add a point about forestry on the in central and eastern Oregon. Conservation easements on forest land, that even the ones that are intended primarily for conservation values, they actually don't have this problem over there because of, since we've had fire suppression for so long, even if you wanted to manage a forest primarily for the conservation values, you first need to do a lot of commercial thinning for years and years and years in order to get the forest back to its more open, less fire-prone status. And so even a conservation easement on the in central and eastern Oregon would, in fact, involve a lot of timber production.
Senator Starr.
Yes, I more comment than question. Conservation, as you are using it, is a very poor definition of conservation. It's a figment of the environmental movement imagination that setting aside property and not using it is conserving. Conserving is using property in a way that every year brings added value to that property through management and use. Setting aside is not conservation, that is preservation, perhaps. But the problem with that is nature has a way of destroying what we would not use and manage well. Insect, disease, fire has a way of taking away those values that we would set aside and not use. Conservation is managed use in a way that is of benefit to mankind. And it really disturbs me to see the term conservation used in a way that ties up property from beneficial uses, even as you describe clean water, fish. These are values, but they are not necessarily the things of which our Creator intended. Thank you, Mr. Chair. I got a load off of my heart.
I know you wanted to, I sense you wanted to say those words. You're free to comment if you like.
The only thing I'd like to add is that the word conservation in this context is actually Oregon statutes follow the federal definition that's outlined in the IRS statute for what qualifies as a conservation donation. And that's we're following the same use because that's what's in the Oregon statutes.
In some ways on this, Ms. Hummond, it seems the definition, and we've seen it here this morning, and we'll continue with this discussion, but in some ways the definition of conservation gets in the way, or it seems to, because I watched this last session, of the program itself, which I've found, at least in my brief, not that strong of arguments. We'll hear from the cattlemen in a moment, but not strong arguments against a voluntary program in nature where the landowner gets more rights and more options. Mm-hmm. But I don't know if there is a way to at least change the name, because I think it evokes strong feelings. It seems to. You wanted to continue.
I've actually addressed most of my points in answering questions. The last thing that I would add is that, yes, people do have many feelings about the word conservation, and there are many definitions of the word conservation. And as a voluntary tool for landowners, as I said before, it's really between the landowner and the holder, which is often a land trust or a land conservancy or a government entity. The definition of conservation is really between the private landowner and whatever entity they're working with to be the holder. We don't determine what it is, what the definition of conservation is, or the goals of the landowner. The goals, many diverse goals of landowners are accommodated by conservation easements.
Mm-hmm. Thank you. Other questions or thoughts for this panel? Thank you very much. If you could stay on hand, we might let you come back after the county and the cattlemen. So if you're free to stick around.
Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members of the committee.
Ralph, how'd the Mariners do last night?
They killed.
They lost. I'm going to mispronounce Tessel.
Yes.
Oh, Ms. Tessel and Ms. Livingston from Oregon Cattlemen Association.
Chair Decker, I do have some written testimony. Chair Deckert, members of the Revenue Committee, the Oregon Cattlemen Association, my name is Kay Tessel with the Oregon Cattlemen Association for the record. We're opposed to Senate Bill 593A because the original intent of farm use assessments was to recognize the impact that agriculture provides to Oregon's character and economy. Agriculture provides a significant return to Oregon's economy, whereas conservation easements provide very little to sustain or build Oregon's economy. The intent of conservation easements is to make land follow, providing nothing in return to the economy. These farm use assessments were originally deemed appropriate in order to provide incentives for operators to retain their farmland rather than developing such land. By allowing conservation easements to be converted to a special assessment, this bill would undermine the original intent of farm assessments. In addition, Senate Bill 593A would prohibit the counties and state from receiving the much-needed tax from this farmland conversion. In a time of such tight budgetary restrictions, Oregon cannot afford to provide tax breaks to land that contributes nothing to the economy. Land that isn't converted to conservation easements should continue to be assessed at the true market value of the land, providing desperately needed revenue to the state. And I'd also like to point out that, you know, usually conservation easements, they're purchased for quite a large sum of money. And that money should, maybe that should be considered when a person's, you know, selling an easement, maybe they should consider the tax liability in that cost.
Thank you.
Chair Deckert, members of the committee, for the record, my name is Sharon Livingston. I'm president-elect of the Oregon Cattlemen Association. I reside in Long Creek, Oregon. That's 90 miles south of Pendleton and 40 miles north of John Day. I live in a county. I'm a full-time rancher. I live in a county that's 60% plus public land. I don't suppose there's anyone on your committee that doesn't understand the pressure right now on public lands. I'm going to speak to you about a specific instance so that you will see why we are opposing this bill. I won't be using names. There are several conservation easements in our county and more coming forth. We've lost a great deal of land to production because of these issues. I sat on the Watershed Council for the North Fork of the John Day River, and we were approached 3 years ago by individuals asking us to get OWEB funding to give to buy a conservation easement because they were going to be taxed at the market value. Their land is not in production, has not been in production for a number of years. They bought it for recreation. They didn't want to pay the extra taxes, so they came to us to get a conservation easement. I was not in favor of using OWEB funds for that because I had just heard the director of OWEB testify that OWEB funds were designed so that the rancher could build a fence and still keep on ranching. So we denied that. Now they're back again, and this time they want a conservation easement, and they want ODFW to provide them with the funds for that. our county cannot afford this. We're living in a county that is financially depressed. We went from $9 million in timber receipts to less than $1 million, and that was 10 years ago. Last year we were allowed to, I think, cut 63 million board feet on the Malheur National Forest. So we're a depressed county. I live in a community where our school is being kept open by bringing in foreign exchange students and boarding them. Our only service station maintenance for any kind of vehicle is closed. You cannot buy gas in Long Creek, Oregon. You have to go to Monument, 25 miles away, John Day, 40 miles, or Pendleton, 90. So I'm speaking to you in this instance because I think this is a poor use of state funds. We need funds for education. I'm also a retired teacher, so I'm very familiar with that. So I'm saying to you that this is locking up property that could be used for production, and I see it on a daily basis in my community. Thank you.
Thank you, and thank you for traveling either this morning or last night to the Capitol.
I've been here 3 days.
Oh, you have.
It's a good experience.
It is a good experience. Thank you for coming. Senator George.
Mr. Chairman, I have in my video file, which is getting to be too big, a videotape of a catastrophic fire that occurred basically between the Redmond area and where you are.
Yes.
And this fire originated moved into a catastrophic event because of the fact that this one-time production cattle ranch had been bought by recreationists, and they had allowed the grass to grow. And the grass became very tall and very thick and very, you know, old and decaying for years and years. When the fire began, in the past, you had agriculturalists there, the ranchers, who all rallied, you know, you remember those days, in order to fight that fire that was started by the lightning. They were gone. And the sad part about the story, and you guys are probably recognizing the fire now, is that eventually it burned through all of that country, causing great erosion problems the following year, by the way, and then headed for the federally owned timber. That is just, to me, was just a sample of what the potential is if you have areas in which the vegetation has grown, you know, to an extent that it is a catastrophic fire that's waiting. Are you seeing that even in your area? Because you are surrounded on those hilltops by beautiful forests.
Chair Deckert, Senator George, I border the National Forest, and I do logging on my place sustainably. It's done the proper way. I only have one person I allow on there to cut trees, and he's a forester and a very good one. I can go right across the fence into the National Forest. You can't ride a horse through. The duff is so thick. My hope is that I keep my timber thinned. I spent a year in Germany, and I saw how they did their forest. That's the way I want mine to look. I take very good care of it. I thin on a regular basis. I maintain it because when the fire comes, and it will, next door to me, I hope that mine is in such good shape it will burn through rapidly. I believe in conservation. My grandfather came to that country. He was a conservationist long before people ever knew what the word was, and he maintained you have to take care of your natural resources, and that's what we do. But he's absolutely right. I drive to Pendleton, and I go through a gorgeous area. It burned. Every time I go through there, I wish I could close my eyes because it will take years for it to come back.
So here's what I grapple with, and your testimony has been really helpful, is I think of the situation in Lincoln County where you have a landowner, and maybe it's a bias of mine that you want to see, you know, in these, maybe, I don't know, I'm picturing Lincoln County with the magnificent cliffs and the trees, and you think of this landowner that perhaps wants to do a conservation easement. And for me, in that situation, at least philosophically, I would say, the state should not stand between that landowner voluntarily making a deal, and this is the capitalist in me, with a private entity to have that stay. I want to be careful with the words here, public trust, or and so I guess the question is why would we, I guess, stand in the way or not allow them the same tax treatment as if they were using that land for production?
Chair Deckard, I understand what you're saying. And I think that's great, but I do what I do with my property, and I conserve it because it's the right thing to do. I don't do it for money. I do it because it's the right thing to do. Here's what I see. There are instances, yes. Maybe you need to go site by site. I don't know what the answer is, but I know in my county what's happening there. When you have people that bought a piece of property strictly for recreation, fine, use it, pay for it. But don't take it out of production and then expect our county that's already financially struggling. And you know, if you've been to Eastern Oregon, you know we're struggling. Mm-hmm. So I understand what you're saying. As always, there are two sides to every issue.
I guess I'm wondering, in some ways, geographically, although, I don't know, I mean, the sponsors would... and I don't know if there's a way to do it by geographical area, or if that, in some ways, I think your objection to it is more just philosophical, that if it's not in production, it should not be given. So that doesn't matter if it's in Canada or Mexico. It's just if it's not in production, it shouldn't have. Is that, that's accurate, that statement?
I guess I have a feeling, too, about the use of dollars this way. Okay, if they want to take it out of production and work out a way to get their taxes reduced, fine, but why do we have to pay them to do that and then reduce the taxes? The instant I'm speaking to you about, they want money for a conservation easement and they also want their taxes reduced. Why not take the conservation easement money, put it in a fund, and pay your taxes to the county? You see what I'm saying? I'm saying they want both. Mm-hmm. They want their property out of production. It's already in pristine condition. They want to be paid for it. They want to keep it. And they also want their taxes reduced.
Mm-hmm. Mr. Chairman, can I?
Yeah, Senator Archer.
Let's go back to the example that our previous speaker used of the Bend area. And let's say I have a farm over there and, you know, getting the age where I'm thinking, oh, I'm going to get rid of this thing. And I've done a nice job of keeping it in production, but somebody wants to buy it and put a lot of houses out there. What happens to me relative to that tax deferral I've been having for all those years if I should sell it for that? I think these folks probably know, but it'd be good for them to hear what I will have, what I'll be required to do if I should take it out of production.
Well, as I understand it, you have to go back and pay the back taxes.
That's it.
Thank you, Barry.
I think we've got Senator Shard, did you? Senator Krasanski.
Senator George, on that example, if they were going to take it out of production and they've been getting a forced deferment and it's going to be developed, wouldn't that scenario probably play out that you would go ahead and log it, capture the timber, and then you'd have the sell in the development, so you actually would be paying your taxes based on the production of harvesting before it actually went into development as housing?
If it was timber, you probably would, but if you look at any of those developments over there, they normally don't cut down the trees where they're going to put the houses in. People want that setting, so that would devalue the potential for actual real estate development in that form. So, but you're right, you would capture some of it back, but any of the other, like on agricultural land, you will pay it for 10 years, if I understand it correctly.
Yes. Other thoughts or questions? Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Appreciate. Hope you have a nice stay. Or is this your last stay here? Or?
I'll be back.
You'll be back. You, Arnold Schwarzenegger. Gail.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman, and members of the committee. For the record, Gil Riddell, Association of Oregon Counties. You've had an excellent discussion of the philosophical issues. I'm actually here to talk about fiscal impact, cost of service issues, and I apologize to the proponents for surprising them this morning. The filing, I've conferred with Jerry Hansen, who the proponents mentioned was on the original. He is the expert for these matters in the Assessors Association. He conferred with his colleagues. He tells me that the filing, Jerry Hansen from Washington County, Director of Assessment Taxation, that the filing process for this is different from the normal assessment taxation process because there are third-party holders and there are landowners involved at the same time. And because these easements will be different enough to require more individualized attention, they're property specific. So there are two sets of responsibilities that they have. And Jerry's estimate is that this will cost, the cost for service over time for this would be represented by an application fee of $250. Now I'll explain the two sets of responsibilities. The first is to process the application. That involves identifying the acreage involved, mapping the easement, recording and maintaining potential additional tax liability, which could be perpetual, dealing with the subsequent owners and title companies who will be very interested in the potential tax liability and also need some background on this particular program. The second set, the counties will probably want to inspect the property to make sure they understand the area and the requirements of the easement. The second set of responsibilities is the periodic review that the bill requires. Every 3 years, the holder of the easement reports to the county assessor that the landowner is maintaining the property according to the agreement. Now, counties likely will want to audit that to make sure that that is in fact the case. This could occur again perpetually every 3 years. If there is a disqualification, then there would be a whole disqualification process that would have to be followed. Now, Jerry and his colleagues tell me that they can that these two sets of requirements over time likely would be represented by an initial application fee of $250. Now that's the extent of my comments. We'd ask for amendments to the bill to provide for that.
Senator Phillips.
Thanks. Did anyone calculate the actual tax loss? I guess you're saying, well, if we're getting this amount from farmland and it's going to be the same, there would be no loss to the counties. But you also don't have the economic activity occurring in the county that was occurring before. Have you guys looked at that portion of it?
Mr. Chair, Senator George, this, of course, is fiscal impact, not revenue impact. You're addressing the revenue impact, and that's certainly an active question. The county family is quite diverse in approach, and so what you've heard thus far from the two previous sets of witnesses is very, very familiar to me. And we have generally stayed out of the specific issue because we can't come to understanding among ourselves about which direction to go. On the one hand, there's no question that this program, the tax deferral, was originally set up for economic purposes. I think the Department of Revenue would likely agree with that. On the other hand, times change, and this program, after long discussion and previous actions by the legislature, was seen to have evolved into this area. I do want to note, though, that the proponents mentioned conservation easements can include harvesting and managing, and we would encourage, of course, those kinds of easement, that's the kind of work that is required, particularly on some landscapes where there hasn't been active management. It does need active management, and that's the kind of conservation easement we support. The other kind typically eventually will just either burn up or become infected and so on. So we're very aware of the need for management, and we would encourage those kinds of conservation easements. The state policy, though, the last two or three sessions has evolved to include a range of conservation values in this program. In terms of specific revenues, if you take it strictly from an economic model, there's certainly revenue impact. No doubt about it.
Another thing, my wife returned from a meeting last week, I believe it was, in which the discussion of West Nile was prominent. And I think back to the old days when, because I lived in an area that had a lot of what we used to call swamps, okay, today would be called wetlands, and it was an enormous cost to taxpayers in order to manage the disease implications of a mosquito population that was very prolific out there in those, quote, swamps. But the question I have is, you know, are you folks looking at, we have recreated a lot of wetland areas, and now they tell us that we are now West Nile infected. So has anybody tried to calculate the implications, or, you know, what kind of treatment are we going to do relative to, you know, the more acres you're going to have to treat, the more it's going to cost. And I know some of these conversions will be to reconverting to wetland.
Mr. Chair, Senator George, that's a very good question. No, we have not.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Justin or Ms. Hummond, anything in closing you'd like to comment upon before we close this work session?
Hearing.
An amendment. Yes, sir.
This is a public hearing.
I'll close this public hearing and adjourn.
Hi, this is Cheryl Hummond again for the record with Defenders of Wildlife. I would like to address a few of the comments that were brought up. Most of the discussion that I've heard does assume that conservation easements are only used for conservation purposes, and there's nothing in statute or law that requires a conservation easement to be only for conservation and not for production. And there are many landowners who are interested in multiple uses of their land and will continue to have some economic production from their property. In addition, I'd like to point out that there are very few conservation easements per year in Oregon, and of those, not that many would take advantage of this new opportunity, this new tool for landowners, and it might be a handful per year. And so I think conservation easements per se and a conservation easement special assessment are not in and of themselves causing wildfires and some of the other problems that were mentioned. In fact, conservation easements require active management by the landowner or by the holder. And so the incidence of fire and disease would not increase on a conservation easement because the landowner doesn't want a diseased forest or a forest fire. And so conservation easement landowners do provide for very active management of their property to enhance whatever values they're interested in. In addition, I appreciate Gil Riddell's comments about the wide uses, the growing uses of special assessments. It's true that the original purpose was for economic uses, for farming and forestry. We do have an open space special assessment in the state, and we also have a wildlife habitat special assessment. So there's already precedent as well as recognition of conservation as a legitimate land use in the state for special assessments to be used for land aside from land that's necessarily in production. I think that's all I have.
Thank you.
Did you have any other questions for us while we're here?
Let me check.
Nope.
Doesn't look. Senator George.
If we were going to compensate the counties for any lost revenue with this from state, that, you know, because we would desire, as we declare in the bill, that we have an interest in this, I'm fine with this concept if it's a willing landowner and the state compensates. But I just am not any more moved to take any more away from counties and cities that are hurting because of decaying economy around their locations. So, thanks.
So there's some one senator's price of admission on this bill is compensation to the county. So Senator Brzezinski.
One other question, I guess. I'm wondering if the witnesses have any information as to any of these conservation areas actually being used for economics in the sense of tourism or some type of means where money would be coming from the benefit of having that land held in these type of settings.
I don't have any specific examples, but I think we all know that tourism and the scenic values and the fish and wildlife values, both hunting and viewing and fishing, are all very important to Oregon's economy, and areas that are used for conservation purposes, whether through a conservation easement or some other tool, definitely provide economic benefits to Oregon.
Cheers.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Appreciate it.
Thank you.
Close public hearing. And we have 9 o'clock tomorrow. We will reconvene. Chair of the committee.